Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
We'll have the votes.
That Senate Republican Mitch McConnell on Fox News Sunday claiming Republicans have the votes to ban filibusters this week. Democrats are also predicting victory in the filibuster debate. Newsweek magazine's apology is also the talk of the town in Washington. Newsweek had reported that U.S. military interrogators flushed a Koran down the toilet, a report which was subsequently blamed for deadly riots in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Newsweek is now saying its source could not be certain it read about the allegations in the government report Newsweek cited. And finally, Washingtonians are still wondering, how close was that plane last week? Well, joining us on the line to talk about all of this and a look at the week ahead in Washington, John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, John.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
Good. And first to this apology coming out of Newsweek magazine. It's about a brief item that the magazine wrote 2 weeks ago in which an anonymous government official said a military investigation coming out soon would show that military interrogators had flushed Korans down the toilet at Guantanamo Bay to get detainees to talk. Now the magazine is saying the anonymous official is backing away from that allegation. Here's an edited version of what editor Mark Whittaker from Newsweek told NPR last night.
We feel terrible about the violence and the role that Newsweek's reporting has played in it. It is not a retraction. It is an acknowledgement that we may have gotten certain things wrong.
Well, and John Harwood, the White House is now saying Newsweek needs to retract this story. An apology is not enough. What are the repercussions?
Well, look, this would be a troubling situation even if the report were proved to be rock solid, because people lost their lives as a result of the violence that followed the report. It's obviously a big embarrassment for Newsweek, however the problem or the issue is defined, whether or not it's something that's flat wrong or simply improperly sourced. I think it's something that ought to give all of us in the journalistic community and in government pause about the kind of things that we pass on to one another and then pass into print.
Perhaps getting more than one source, but online blogs are pointing out today, John, that the Philadelphia Inquirer had cited the same allegations about Korans last January. And General Richard Myers, chair of the Joint Chief of Staffs, said the rioting in Afghanistan was more related to politics within Afghanistan and not the story about the Koran. And one online blogger, The Daily Kos, is saying that right-wing conservatives are railroading Newsweek. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know enough about all of the details to know whether that is a valid charge. I do know the Washington Post, in its account of what happened in Newsweek today, said that it had published a report with some similarities to what Newsweek had reported in terms of what had happened with the Quran in some of these circumstances. So it may not have completely been news of first impression. It may be have been seized on for moments that are particular to the timing that we're in right now, but that doesn't lessen the sense of regret that Newsweek has right now over something that they've had to clarify and apologize for.
Well, Newsweek says they're going to continue to investigate the allegation. Let's move on to the filibuster. If you could have been a fly on the wall at the dinner that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and his Democratic counterpart Harry Reid had at Frist's home last night, what might you have heard?
Well, you might have heard about some compromise talks that have been ongoing, prodded by senior members in both parties who really don't want to walk into the abyss that the so-called nuclear option might generate. People who've been in the Senate a long time, who appreciate the way it functions, the way it gives every senator the right to obstruct, hold up, make their voice heard in certain circumstances, the way it's supposed to cool the passions of the House, think that that could be endangered by what's happening here. Now, Bill Frist, who wants to run for president in 2008, who wants religious conservatives who want this fight to like him, may have put himself in a bit of a box. But there is always time until this happens for some sort of deal to get struck construct that might allow Democrats to preserve their future right to filibuster, perhaps in a Supreme Court fight that might come later this year, while letting some of these judges they've blocked go through.
And by the way, if there is no compromise, how soon this week might we see the two nominees come up that might lead to this ban on filibusters, the ban from the majority party, the Republicans?
Well, I think we first are going to see Leader Frist put forward a couple of the nominees that Democrats have blocked, people like Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown, not Supreme Court nominees, nominees for lesser courts, but Democrats nevertheless, because of their political views or what Democrats characterize as their political views, have been holding them up. Those are the sort of test cases and they could be the precipitating events for the invocation of the nuclear option. The Senate's working on the highway bill in the early part of the week, so I think at the earliest it will come in the latter part of the week. But again, if these compromise talks gather steam, you could see the potential confrontation put off until next week.
And John, we just have a few seconds, so I'm afraid I have to ask you for a yes or no. Are there still questions in Washington this week about how that plane got so close to the Capitol last week and why it wasn't, for instance, shot down?
Well, yes, there are questions about it, but I think it was pretty quickly determined by authorities that it wasn't a huge national security threat, and they did scramble, and were in a position to prevent an attack if they determined that that's what this little Cessna posed, but they determined that it didn't.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks so much.
You bet.
And staying in Washington, the president's Social Security reform proposal is facing serious opposition in Congress. President Bush says by setting up personal accounts, Americans would have more control over their retirement savings. But critics say the plans would leave Americans vulnerable to the vagaries of the stock market and that most Americans aren't up to the challenge of adjusting their portfolios anyway. Well, Los Angeles Times national economics correspondent Peter Goslin decided to survey 11 Nobel Prize-winning economists to see how well they did with their own retirement investments, and their answers might give some fuel to critics of the president's plan. And Peter joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Peter, let's start with the man who is the so-called father of modern portfolio theory. Can you tell us what that is and how he fared on his own portfolio?
Sure, Robin. Harry Markowitz was one of three men who won the Nobel Prize in 1990 for something called modern portfolio theory, which is, when you boil it down, it's basically don't put all your eggs in one basket. Mm. You should diversify your investments. And it turns out that, he does diversify, but it is the simplest. It's the kindergarten version of diversification. He basically split most of his money right down the middle, put half of it in stocks and half in a very, very low interest investment. That does follow the rules that he put forth in his theory, but it's about as simple-minded as you can get. And if the guy who invented the thing can only do the kindergarten version or only does the kindergarten version, then you wonder how the rest of America is going to do.
Well, and as he says, in retrospect, looking back, it would have been better to put more in stocks, riskier stocks when he was younger and could afford it, but he didn't do that.
That's right. And I think one of the things that people have to think about when they're trying to take the measure of President Bush's proposal for personal accounts in Social Security is essentially what do they have to hit? What marker do they have to hit in their investments in that account to at least break even? And the fact is that if you took the Harry Markowitz approach to the investing the portion of Social Security that would be diverted into these personal accounts, I don't think you'd break even.
Because as you write, under the president's plan, if you do opt to divert Social Security monies to private investment, there's a small percentage charge. And with inflation, you need to make back more than that to break even. And as you just pointed out, Nobel laureate Markowitz only made about 2% on his investments, so that wouldn't have been enough. But you spoke to 11 Nobel Prize winners. How did they fare overall?
Well, they seem to have made all of the kinds of investment mistakes that you and I make. Some of them can't make a decision about where to put their money, and so they park it in low-interest investments. Some of them bet wrong on the market and either didn't get the ride up or took the whole ride down. So here we have some of the smartest people in economics in this country. And lo and behold, they're just like the rest of us.
Well, in fact, you had quotes such as, "I know it's utterly stupid," that from George Akerlof, the 2001 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Tell us some of the other things that some of the Nobel Prize winners you spoke to said.
These were fun conversations. These are smart people. I'm not for a moment claiming that they're in any financial duress, but some of the folks had pretty funny stories to tell. The one that jumps to mind is Douglas North, the economic historian who won a Nobel Prize in 1993. And he decided that in 1993, the stock market had topped out, and he wasn't going to waste the time putting money in the stock market. So he put it in cautious, tax-exempt municipal bonds. And, of course, as we all know, the stock market took off like a bat out of hell after that, and he lost all of that run-up. And as he pointed out, he said that his wife spent years berating him. And so I asked him, well, what happened then? And it turns out he hung on to those bonds as the market went back down again after 2000. And I said, so you got your reward. And he said, yes, he did, that his wife stopped berating him.
Another group of very smart people also doesn't seem to either want to participate or know how to participate. You also took this question to Harvard. What'd you find?
Basically, when you become a Harvard professor or a Harvard staff member, they ask you, where do you want to invest your retirement money? And half of the staff and faculty of Harvard say nothing, don't give an answer. And when they don't give an answer, it's defaulted into basically a money market account, you know, that's yielding about 2%. So at any given time, about half of Harvard's faculty and staff haven't made a so-called affirmative election for how they want their retirement money invested. So it gets invested really poorly.
Well, since Nobel laureates appear to be at a loss as to what to do on some occasions, we shouldn't be afraid to admit we don't know what to do. So a few questions for you that we gathered here in the office. What's the difference between a pension and a 401k?
A pension is a retirement arrangement where your employer promises to provide you a certain benefit once you retire for as long as you live. The employer sets aside money. The employer is responsible for investing that money. If the investments don't go well, the employer is still responsible for delivering those benefits to you. A 401k is a tax advantage savings account that can be sponsored by your employer, into which your employer may make contributions, and you are responsible for making all the investment decisions. The beauty part of 401ks from an employer's point of view is that it limits their risk and their responsibility. They've agreed to pay some money, but it's just a certain amount of money, and after that, they're done with it.
Well, and let's describe further. I know when I first got this huge booklet here where I work, with the options that I had, there were all sorts of pie charts and all sorts of explanations. Mm-hmm. There are sometimes very many choices between riskier investments and very low-risk investments. Tell us more about that.
Well, the fact is that over the course of time, with most employers, the number of choices of where you can put your money has gone up, and plan sponsors keep adding choices. But one of the findings of recent studies in economics is that the more choices people are given, the less likely they are to do the choosing. Americans are happy to say they're for choice. It's one of those things we're just plain for in the abstract. But you present them with these situations, and not surprisingly, we all get confused, and when we get confused, we tend to either not make the choice or take the lowest risk choice or split the difference and kind of come down the middle. And those kind of default positions that we take are not necessarily the wise investment thing to do.
We're speaking to Peter Goslin. He's national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. When we come back, how many retirement plans are moving away from choice and how Americans are throwing retirement money away. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about retirement accounts with Los Angeles Times national economics correspondent Peter Goslin, and also talking about the mistakes people, including Nobel Prize-winning economists, make when setting up these accounts. More and more companies are moving towards 401k programs. These are savings accounts which companies set up and often then match the funds that employees put into the accounts. And Peter, you write about a study that shows that more than a quarter of people eligible for these accounts, essentially free money from your employer, these people don't sign up for them, which amounts to throwing money away.
That's right. We've had more than 20 years of experience now with 401ks. And, you know, some people have done very, very well. But a huge fraction of people either don't opt in, fail to make the decision to even start the thing, or once they get in, they make a series of mistakes that result in a rough and ready term, sort of a third, not doing anywhere near as well as the perfect models if everybody was a perfect economic player. So that the record, I think, on 401ks is that, yes, some people do well, but if this is the safety net that is supposed to protect people in their old age, and they're on their own and making these investment decisions, we're going to have a huge fraction of America not doing well in old age, not having enough money to maintain their material standard of living.
But Peter, going back to the idea that, you know, people who, you know, would have employer contributions into a savings plan don't even take advantage of that. You quote someone as saying that's like leaving $100 bills on the sidewalk and not picking it up. Why are they not participating?
Robin, ask yourself, you got a book full of options and pie charts, and you were starting a new job, and you're a journalist, and there's loads of demands for getting the next story, and I'll bet anything you put it off. I'll bet it was in that to-do pile that you had on your desk. You were going to get to that, and we're all going to get to it, and some of us actually do get to it, but a huge fraction of people kind of never get to it. You just have to remember that if this is the safety net that is going to protect people in old age, do you want a quarter of the country's old people to be so ill-prepared? That's the reason why, traditionally, we've had a public social insurance system that's basically required everybody to kick in payroll taxes into Social Security and given everybody a benefit. We forget that most people, most of the time, are about the task of living their lives. They're not angling around to figure out where the next dollar can be made, and they don't make a lot of financial decisions. Either plain don't make them or they don't make them wisely.
Well, but let's also say that supporters of President Bush's plan say that the young people that he's appealing to are people who have grown up knowing about investing. It's a different generation. And also that this plan is the only way for poor people to have money to invest. In other words, if they take some of their Social Security and invest that, that's the only opportunity they're going to get to have investments. They're not in a 401k plan, for instance.
That's right. The president's argument is that they don't have the free cash that middle-income and upper-middle-income Americans have to invest. You've got to weigh against that the fact that they get rather substantial benefits from being sure of a payment available to them when they retire in the form of Social Security traditional benefits. The president's main argument on this, the way he would have us do this trade-off, is he says you can't measure how people could do in these accounts against what's been promised them in Social Security, because at some point in 2042, the trust fund out of which most Social Security payments are supposed to come will run out of money, and then it will be just a pay-as-you-go system. But the fact that's forgotten is that even if the trust fund runs out of money, Social Security will still pay 75% of its benefits. So you've got to decide, can you do better than that? And I think the answer for many people is no.
We're talking to Los Angeles Times national economics correspondent Peter Goslin, who surveyed 11 Nobel Prize winners in economics to see how well they did in their retirement investments, and come to find out, not well at all. And so the question we're posing is, you know, how can you do well if they can't? And Peter, we also talked about how, you know, more than a quarter of people eligible for these employer-provided 401ks, where employers put into your savings account, match what you put into a savings account. More than a quarter of those eligible don't even sign up for them. But you also found that some big companies have started to remove the number of choices that they offer to those eligible for these accounts. And that seemed to make it easier for people to invest.
After 20 years of experience with 401ks, a lot of big American companies have become uncomfortable that they're letting people essentially make a lot of financial mistakes that are going to hurt them when they get to old age. And in fact, they're moving, if not away from accounts, they're moving to impose many more controls on accounts, so that instead of having to sign up when you joined National Public Radio and pick an account, you'd be automatically signed up unless you objected. And instead of having to pick an investment option, you'd be automatically dumped into a reasonable investment option. So there's a lot of attempts to basically be sure there's a path of decisions made for you if you're not going to make them for yourself.
Well, and the direction the 401k world is going seems to be doing very well. You note that Fidelity, for instance, has a life cycle fund And it's jumped from $6.6 billion to $33.6 billion in 4 years, according to the company. And again, it puts employees where it thinks they should be in the investment pie chart. For instance, if you're young, maybe you have riskier investments with bigger returns, right?
And if
you're older, more cautious investments. But it just puts you in them.
Well, that's right. The big 401k plan providers are beginning to offer these things where they not only default you into an investment, but they tweak the dials, they turn the dials, they adjust how much is in equities and how much is in safer bonds as you get older. Because again, this is another area where people who are looking at the 401k experience say, wait a minute, people just aren't making these decisions. People aren't doing them.
Peter Goslin, Los Angeles Times national economics correspondent, after he surveyed 11 Nobel Prize winners in economics to find out that, they didn't do that well in their own portfolios. Peter, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, the lawyers making the case for Saddam Hussein. And a life-size Barbie teaches girls about healthy eating. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, public radio is looking at globalization and how it's changing the way people live their lives. Well, today at Here and Now, we begin a series of reports that looks at how free trade with the U.S. and Canada is changing life for many Mexicans. One of the benefits of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was signed back in 1994, was the promise of new roads in Mexico. An improved road system would help farmers get their produce to bigger markets faster. But as reporter Mary Stuckey found out, not every Mexican is eager to have a superhighway nearby.
Several hundred families live in Morro Mazatlan on southern Mexico's Pacific coast, but there is only one telephone in town. An incoming call is announced to the entire village, a village of one- and two-room houses, many with thatched palm roofs spread along a winding dirt track. On this day in mid-morning, 76-year-old Serapio Ramirez is making his way down the road through town. He's driving a wooden cart pulled by two oxen. Here, ox carts are more common than cars. Ramirez is a campesino, a farmer growing corn, squash, and sorghum. The land in Morro Mazatlan is so fertile, crops can be harvested twice a year, but the area remains one of the poorest in Mexico. Cornfields border the road from the town to the beach. It's slow going, swerving to avoid the ruts. Finally, the beach. Playa Cangrejo. White sand, a quiet bay, palms, pelicans, impossibly blue water, and a handful of open-air restaurants. Their thatched roofs sheltering a few plastic tables in the sand. On this day in midweek, the beach is empty, except for a fisherman mending his net. Jorentino Gonzalez sells his catch of shrimp, octopus, and a fish called Sierra in Morro Mazatlan. It's a distance of just 8 miles, but it takes him half an hour. He says he dreams of a better road.
When it rains, it creates a lot of mud and ruts, and this road is very difficult.
The government agrees that Morro Mazatlan needs a better road, but not from the beach to the village center. Instead, they proposed a 4-lane superhighway connecting the town to the cities of the north. The idea was to bring more tourists to lovely Cangrejo Beach, but people here said no to the road and to the flood of tourists it was supposed to bring. Isaiah Seferino owns one of the little restaurants on the beach.
I don't think these are compatible interests. Big companies are not interested in the villages. We'd like the tourism to come in an orderly way. We don't want people to come and make this place dirty and bring other types of cultures and invade us with other customs.
So the farmers in Moral-Mazatan stopped the highway project in its tracks, refusing to give permission for the road to cross their land. A 14-hour bus ride to the north, a tangle of superhighways surrounds the plush offices of the Inter-American Development Bank. Larry Harrington runs the bank's Mexico City office. He says good roads improve life for everyone.
Big roads are important because people move in this country, and it's also important to be able to get access to medical treatment, to get kids to school, all of those things. It's also important to move goods.
A new toll road has been built some 40 miles from Moral-Mazatan. To drive on it costs about 10 cents a mile.
Gracias, muy amable.
That's an exorbitant sum for the average Mexican. There are hardly any cars or trucks on the road, but there are people riding bicycles and a man driving a wooden ox cart. The Mexican government has created a massive plan called the Plan Puebla Panama, or PPP. It's designed to bring roads, electricity, and telecommunications to the poorest southern states of Mexico, linking south through Central America all the way to Panama. The plan was the target of such vigorous protest that it was actually shut down for a while. Now, with the help of an American public relations firm, it's back up and running. Claudia Salgado is an official of the PPP.
It's not a project that can be done overnight. It's not something by the book that you can just follow the recipe and execute just like that. These are long-term plans, and we're trying to build consensus.
So far, 85% of the PPP's budget has been spent on roads. Throughout Mexico, activist groups organized to fight the project and to promote alternative development. They say they want development efforts to benefit the poorest communities. Take, for example, a village called El Porvenir, which on this day is preparing for a fiesta. El Porvenir is about 100 miles north of Moral-Mazatan. This area gets a lot of wind. 28 companies from the United States and Europe have expressed interest in the area of El Porvenir. The companies want to rent land from the communities and build turbines to generate electricity from the wind. That's a good idea, says Arturo Racia, a teacher in El Porvenir, but only if the villagers can get a fair deal.
Uno de los beneficios que yo como particular solicitaría.
One of the benefits that I personally will ask for is that the company would absorb the cost of the electricity for the community. And that is what we are going to solicit directly as a village.
The wariness that meets big infrastructure projects here grows out of a history full of stories about the rich exploiting the poor. Back on the beach in Moral-Mazatan, 84-year-old Amado Zeferino sits at one of the oceanfront restaurants, reflecting on his life. He says he enjoys studying history, even though he never went to school and had to teach himself to read. When he was a boy, Zeferino says foreign businessmen built ports near Moral-Mazatan. He says the businessmen became rich on the backs of the local workers.
Y nosotros aquí, de esclavo, de mozo.
Those of us here were slaves, servants. And what they did to us during those days, the government wants to do again. They're going to have us do all the work where it's too hot or uncomfortable, and then they'll exploit us, and we'll be slaves. That's what we're thinking is going to come if we don't get together and defend ourselves.
And so that's what the people of Moral-Mazatan did. They've said no to the big roads and the international plans for development and free trade. In this small place where almost no one owns a car or has much of anything to sell, they're refusing to give their land for a road that they say will make someone else rich and destroy the one thing they cherish, Playa Cangrejo, this unspoiled white sand beach.
That report from Mary Stuckey. Tomorrow we'll have a report about how international pharmaceutical companies are trying to bioprospect in Mexico, trying to find out what Mexicans have long known about the medicinal qualities of plants. You're listening to Here and Now. And now, free trade and China. A trade war may be brewing between the U.S. and China over textiles. The Bush administration announced Friday a move to restrict imports of cotton shirts, pants, and underwear from China. Over the weekend, Chinese officials said that would violate free trade agreements and could provoke countermeasures. Tensions between the two countries have been escalating since the end of December, when a worldwide textile quota system expired. Well, here and now, business reporter Mark Mills joins us in the studio to see if these textile charges and countercharges are made out of whole cloth. Sorry. Sorry, and welcome, Mark.
All right. Thanks, Robin.
Well, so why did the Bush administration start this process of curbing imports of clothing made in China?
Well, for more than three decades, a textile quota system regulated the trade of clothing. And 10 years ago, it was agreed to let that system expire at the end of last year. And that turned out to be the starting gun of a dramatic surge in exports of Chinese-made apparel. Sales of Chinese textiles and apparel rose 62% in the first quarter of this year compared to a year ago. Some categories, such as cotton pants, have boomed 1,500% since January 1. China now controls 17% of the U.S. clothing market, up from 12% in December. So during the first quarter, according to government reports, 16,000 U.S. textile jobs were lost and 18 factories closed. So pressure has been mounting in Washington to do something about the trade imbalance with China, and this move by the Bush administration signals a tougher stance on trade issues with the Chinese.
You know, just an anecdotal observation, I happened to be in a store for the rare time this past weekend. Every single item was made in China.
Well, I've heard stories about Chinese tourists who come to the U.S. They want to buy something made here to bring home, and all they can find is stuff made in China.
Made in China. Well, if the quota system has expired, what can the Bush administration do about this surge in Chinese products?
As part of China joining the World Trade Organization in 2001, it was agreed that China's trading partners could impose restrictions if their domestic markets were being disrupted by Chinese imports. Those restrictions, though, can't reduce Chinese exports. They can only slow the growth in exports to a rate of 7.5% a year, and even those rules would expire in 2008. So any invoking of these rules really only slows the growth rate of China's exports and will only last a few more years.
But it also raises the question, you know, consumers have been getting bargain prices for goods produced in China. So how would that, you know, slowing of the growth rate of Chinese exports affect shoppers here?
Restricting imports of the Chinese low-cost Chinese goods could lead to less supply and higher prices for consumers. Also, cotton growers in Texas and California who sell raw cotton to China could be hurt if Chinese production is cut. So there's not a unanimous view on this. But the head of the National Council of Textile Organizations, it's a trade association of textile companies, said the Bush administration move will save thousands of jobs.
What do you think? Will it?
Well, you know, it may not be as helpful as supporters are hoping. The National Retail Federation, of course, representing stores and low prices for consumers, says slapping quotas on China won't make the U.S. industry more competitive. Some analysts say if China imports are restricted, buyers will just order more low-cost merchandise from India and Pakistan. They'll just switch. Or Chinese manufacturers could skirt the restrictions by shipping the goods to a third country and then having them shipped to the U.S., and it would be hard to track down.
So how much of what we heard this past weekend with the Bush administration saying they were going to impose some rules, how much is just political posturing?
Well, some of it clearly is, but there definitely is a legitimate bone to pick with China on the trade situation. Critics say China is not adequately enforcing copyright laws, for example, leading to the theft of billions of dollars of intellectual property rights of U.S. companies, that China's currency is artificially low, which makes their goods cheaper throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans, by the way, are just as upset about the clothing situation as the U.S., and they're planning their own action. The Chinese are also accused of providing tax breaks to exporting industries in China, giving them an unfair advantage in global trade. China alone accounts for 27% of the U.S. trade deficit now, and that's just an imbalance that can't go on indefinitely.
Well, so China has threatened some countermeasures, and the minute we have, what can they do?
Well, for one thing, Robin, they could stop buying huge sums of U.S. Treasury bonds, or they could sell substantial amounts of their holdings of Treasury securities. The Chinese are lending us money to help finance both our federal deficit and the yawning trade gap. If they stop doing that, it could lead to higher U.S. interest rates and a slower growing economy. So the Chinese have some leverage. On the other hand, it doesn't help China to do severe damage to its top customers. So we'll have to see how this plays out.
Right. In the meantime, people are going to be looking closer at their labels on their clothing.
Yes.
Here now, business reporter Mark Mills talking to us about the growing conflict between the U.S. and China over textiles. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Before Oprah Winfrey, before our beloved Terry Gross, the daytime talk queen was Mary Margaret McBride.
It's 1 o'clock, and here's Mary Margaret McBride.
Our guest today is a great American legend. Of course, I'm talking about Tallulah. Probably the one person in America today whose first name just goes. You don't even have to think of Bankhead, but you know what?
Mary Margaret McBride ruled the daytime airwaves during the 40s and 50s. Some argue she was one of the best interviewers radio ever had, chatting with everyone from Eleanor Roosevelt to Joe DiMaggio, from Harry Truman to Zora Neale Hurston. McBride is now the subject of a new biography. It's called It's 1 o'clock, and here is Mary Margaret McBride. It's by historian Susan Ware, and Susan joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I have to confess, I feel like an idiot. Here I am, I work in radio. I had never heard of her. Had you heard of her before you found her obituary while you were researching your biographical dictionary? It's called Notable American Women. Had you heard of her before then?
No, I hadn't. I think my mother might have listened to her, perhaps my grandmother, but I didn't. So I came to her entirely as a historian with no preconceived notions.
And she was so big. Just describe it for us. How big was her program at its height?
She would draw 6 to 8 million listeners every day. And at the time, there really weren't too many other shows like her. And one of the things that was so distinctive about her was how she was able to draw an incredibly loyal audience, mainly of housewives, who literally every day at 1 o'clock stopped what they were doing and tuned into her show.
Right. And yet, critics, the largely male critics and writers at the time, Time Magazine, Newsweek, when you share with us some of these reviews that you found, they didn't get her.
They didn't get her at all, and they dismissed her by using words like radio's chatterbox or saying that what she talked about was goo. And I think that what they really weren't prepared to admit was that as a woman and as on daytime radio, she actually had something to say. Mm-hmm. They realized that it was actually a wonderfully intelligent, literate, but approachable discussion of events, news, Broadway plays, and that it was very, very far indeed from goo.
Everybody who was anyone appeared on her show. Mm-hmm. Eleanor Roosevelt was a close friend and was on the program often. But let's listen to a portion of an interview with actress Tallulah Bankhead.
You know what tickled me, Tallulah, was thinking what you'd have been like if you'd taken Ethel Barrymore's advice and had been Frances Bankhead.
Well, darling, it may have saved me a lot of trouble. I don't know.
You mean
because Tallulah is a connotation of good and bad. It's whipped up a lot of rumors and legends, and sometimes I get credit where it isn't due, and sometimes blame where it isn't. But I take the blame for everything and a little credit, too, so I'm not apologizing.
What was it? I mean, just hearing snippets doesn't really get at why she was such a good interviewer. What do you think she did that made people respond to her?
I think when people sat down to be interviewed, they really realized that she was, that the person was the total focus of her energy. She once said to Orson Welles, "I've been thinking of nobody else for the last 48 hours. She had incredible preparation. She had a total memory. And so she would come in to the radio show with no notes. And all of a sudden she would start reciting passages from someone's book, or she would remember some anecdote. And they could just tell that this interview really took them seriously and really wanted them to show off. And so she made them feel comfortable in a way that then loosened up any kind of inhibitions or hostility or just not wanting to be there.
For her time and being a woman in her time, she really did touch on a lot of important issues. I'm thinking of how she spoke of the Negro issue,
mm-hmm.
Anti-Semitism. How was that received?
Here is where her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt really expanded her social conscience. And I think that one of the advantages of having such a loyal audience was that they were willing to be prodded or led by her. They might never have thought about the issue of Negro civil rights, as it would have been put in 1948. I think she really used the bully pulpit of her radio show. She used it sparingly, but there's a real consistent pattern where she is trying to stretch people's minds and to really encourage them to face some of the major issues of World War II, the post-war world, the rise of communism, and civil rights.
And she had to use her bullet pulpit sparingly for issues because she needed it for selling products. It's amazing how you describe how back then, I mean, it's a recent history, but we forget how there was such a thin line between programming and commercials.
Well, I think that's the hardest thing for people today to really grasp. But in fact, the commercials are often the most amusing and interesting part of the show because of the way that she's able to bring the audience in, and also just because of the incredible sincerity and excitement that she brings to all of her products. They're like her children.
This is the bread that has a wonderful crust and a fine flavor. This is the bread that makes those good sandwiches. This is the bread that makes that exceptional toast. This is enriched tip-top bread.
Now, before you're saying, oh, that sounds so ditzy, Mike Wallace did commercials, too. I mean, everybody did them back then.
Yeah.
Was she a feminist?
She certainly was very pro-woman. She believed women could do almost anything, and she was very proud of what women did in their homes as well.
Yeah. And we can't talk about Mary Margaret McBride without talking about her longtime producing partner, and maybe more, a woman named Stella Karn. What a character in and of herself. She ran Mary Margaret's show. They were inseparable for decades. Were they a couple? And does it matter?
I think it matters because certainly they were the most important emotional person for each other. They're for almost 30 years. Yet they aren't a conventional lesbian couple in the ways that we think about it now. And yet, clearly, they worked together. They spent all their time together. They cared deeply about each other. They fought like cats and dogs. But in the end of the day, each one was the most important person to the other.
They had a huge family of 8 million listeners.
And lots of money and living on Central Park South. And what's interesting to me is that Mary Margaret McBride is speaking mainly to an audience, presumably, of married housewives, and she's relating to their lives, and yet her life as a dynamic career woman in New York couldn't be farther from theirs.
Right. Again, going back to just how big a figure was Mary Margaret McBride, so many millions of listeners who would buy anything she asked them to buy, mm-hmm. who would read anything she asked them to read, and chose to be single.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Oprah.
Well, that was the comparison that came to my mind as well. Each of them really took their audience seriously and tried to be a facilitator of new ideas and concerns in a way that really became embedded in people's daily lives.
And as well, Mary Margaret McBride paved the way for everyone who came after, because now it just feels so silly, the criticism of, you know, daytime programming, and it just feels so silly today.
I think one thing I hadn't quite realized was how a format like The Today Show is really very similar to the format of her show, with multiple guests and multiple sponsors. But did she get any credit for that? No. In fact, a lot of the early television formats were adapted directly from radio without very much credit being given.
Well, the credit is given now in your new book. It's called It's 1 o'clock and Here's Mary Margaret McBride, a radio biography by Susan Ware. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
It's 1 o'clock, and here transcribed is Mary Margaret McBride,
who is practically worn out, because here we are speaking from Stella Karn's country residence, Dunloe.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.